I'm going to continue with Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 7, starting with 8, 9, and 10. This morning we discussed number 7, text 7, and there were some of us that not together this morning, so I'll do a little review like I did this morning. In the verses we're going to be discussing, it includes the Atmarama verse. You heard of the Atmarama verse? Atmarama. This one verse has one entire chapter of Chaitanya Charitamrita dedicated to explaining it. It's this Atmarama verse that upon hearing it being explained by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya got a realization. And his realization was that Lord Chaitanya is Krishna. Because Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was a Maha Pandit. He was truly a Bhattacharya, not just by name. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, when he was young, he and his brother, younger brother, the home of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is in Navadvip. When we go this October or the end of Kartik, we're going to Mayapur, we'll visit Vidyanagar, where the school, where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu attended school as a young boy and became Nimai Pandit. Is, and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was the elder brother of Lord Chaitanya's teacher. No, the elder brother of one of the main teachers in Navadvipa. Vidya Vachaspati. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was such a renowned scholar throughout all of India that the king of Orissa, Maharaj Prataparudra, personally visited him and invited him to come and be his chief pundit in his kingdom. Because he was the most renowned scholar in all of India. There's more detail. There was one branch of knowledge that Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya had not mastered, and it was the science of Nyaya. There's details. The seat of high learning of Nyaya was in one faraway city, and they didn't want to teach anybody. It would be a competitor because they had like corner of the market of Nyaya. So Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya went there, studied. They wouldn't give him any of his texts, but he memorized the texts and went back and wrote them and then taught so that his teaching was complete. So before Nimai Pandit appeared in Navadvip, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, who was previously from Navadvip, was invited by the king to become the chief pundit. And his residence was in Puri. And he was such a pundit that he had thousands of disciples. Students, but they are referred in Chaitanya Charitamrita as disciples, including sannyasis, were his disciples. He was a grihastha, but qualified. Super qualified. And so, when he first met Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the circumstance you probably all know, when Mahaprabhu first entered the Jagannath temple after his pilgrimage from Navadvipa to go to Jagannath Puri, at the request of Mother Sachi to make that his headquarters rather than Vrindavan. So he made his journey heading in a southerly direction. Not exactly, but in that direction. And ended up in Jagannath Puri. And he entered the Jagannath temple alone because his danda had been broken in three places by Lord Nityananda and thrown in the river. So Lord Chaitanya said, I don't want to travel with you anymore. My only possession, my danda, I entrusted to you and you lost it, or whatever you did with it. I don't want to travel with you anymore. You go alone. I'll stay behind and you go ahead, or I'll go ahead and you stay behind, but I'm not going to travel with you anymore. But anyway, they said, no, you go first. So he went first and entered into Jagannath temple so that the following lila could be enacted in the absence of his associates. He saw Lord Jagannath as Krishna, holding a flute, standing in threefold bending form, and he saw Krishna, and as he's been searching for Krishna, he saw Krishna, so he ran with his arms outstretched to embrace Krishna, and he was in such a state of ecstasy, he fell to the ground unconscious. And when the guards saw this young 24-year-old handsome sadhu fall to the ground unconscious, they didn't know what he was, what's going on, so they were going to beat him and throw him out of the temple. Just then Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya came into the temple. He said, no, stop. He's a sannyasi. I'm chief priest of the king, and you make arrangements for him to be brought in his unconscious state to my home. He went right to the home of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, still unconscious. And then the residents, or the associates of Mahaprabhu, they also, soon thereafter, they reached the Jagannath temple. Chaitanya Bhagavat describes that when Lord Nityananda saw Balaram, he ran to the altar and they tried to stop him, but he was too powerful. And then they came to know that have you seen one young sannyasi? Well, yes, there was somebody that came here and he was carrying on in such a way we were going to beat him, but Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya requested to take him to his home. I thought, oh, we know who that is. He fell unconscious. We know this behavior of Mahaprabhu. And so they went to the home of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya and they saw Lord Chaitanya unconscious. So they knew what to do. They had loud kirtan for a long time, chanting very loudly. Finally, Lord Chaitanya came to external consciousness, hearing their kirtan. So there was some introduction and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya made the request of Mahaprabhu that please don't go to the temple alone, always go with me. That way you'll be safe if anything happens. And then he invited Lord Chaitanya, there's more detail, but he invited Lord Chaitanya to come to his home to be protected as such a young sannyasi, so attractive in physical feature. How will you maintain your vows of sannyas unless you rigidly study Vedanta Sutra under a scholar like me? So if you like, I'll train you in Vedanta Sutra. Come to my home tomorrow morning. Yes, you're so kind. You'll protect my spiritual life. You okay with that? On your lap? Okay. So Lord Chaitanya came to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's home. And for a whole week, every day, morning until evening, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was giving the explanation of Vedanta Sutra according to the teachings of Shankaracharya to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who said nothing. Nada, as they say in Spanish. Nothing. So the next morning, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya said, "Why are you saying nothing? I don't understand if you're following my explanation of Vedanta Sutra or not, because you don't say anything. You don't ask any question. You don't say yes. You don't disagree. You don't say anything. Are you understanding Vedanta Sutra?" Lord Chaitanya said, "I understand Vedanta Sutra very well, but your explanations, the more you speak, the more it's clouding the meaning of Vedanta Sutra." And Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was taken aback by that remark and said, "Oh, you understand Vedanta Sutra? Then you explain it to me." Lord Chaitanya said, "You're my superior. How can I explain it to you? But on your order, I can do as you say." So he gave an explanation of Vedanta Sutra that was so astounding. And you can find it in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Now, remember, what is Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's opulence? He's this mega scholar. And he said, "Everything that you have said is true. It's true that the indirect explanations of Vedanta Sutra of Shankaracharya are such that it covers the meaning. And now that you explained it this way, it's all very clear. It's a miracle. It's so simple, so direct. Could you now explain this Atmarama verse?" And Lord Chaitanya gave an explanation. He said, "Can you explain the Atmarama verse?" "Oh, yes, I can explain the Atmarama verse. I'm Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. Certainly I can explain it." And he gave some number of meanings, 13 or something like that number of meanings. He said, "How did you like my meanings?" And Mahaprabhu said, "Well, they were very nice, but there's another way to understand the Atmarama verse." "Oh, can you explain?" Lord Chaitanya explained in 64 different ways without repeating even one of the ways of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya in 64 other ways. One verse that takes up one chapter of Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's way up here. It's one of those chapters, you read it again and you don't understand it, so you read it again and you don't understand it, so you read it again and you don't understand it, so you read it again and you still don't understand it. It's up there. But Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya could understand it because he's a super scholar. And from hearing from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu on a level of scholarship, which was so elevated, not just intricate, but Krishna conscious, that he had the realization, nobody could explain like this except Krishna himself. You're Krishna himself. I now understand, you are Krishna, you're not just a sannyasi. You're Krishna himself, because his brother-in-law, Gopinath Acharya, had already chastised Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. "The Supreme Lord is in your home. He who the scriptures speak about is the cause of all causes, the Supreme Personality of God. It is in your home and you don't recognize him." And Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya said, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa. What authority are you saying he's the personality of God? The explanations in the scriptures are full." And he gave a number of them, but what's the use of presenting this understanding to a person like you? Only by the mercy of the personality of God himself will you understand. Because it's not by scholarship that you can understand. It's by the mercy of the Supreme Lord that one can understand. One day you will understand. because the Lord will be merciful upon you. Because his nature is he's merciful. He's come to your home. So when Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya realized Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's non-difference from Krishna, and he expressed like that, then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu showed his form, his Sadbhuj form. Those of you that have been to the home of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, you've seen Sadbhuj, six-armed form. So, two hands Krishna, two hands Ram, two hands the sannyasi. So, flute, bow and arrow of Ram, and danda and kamandalu of Mahaprabhu, of a sannyasi. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya fainted. And he then shortly thereafter composed spontaneously in Sanskrit 100 verses flowing like the Ganges and some of the devotees of glorification of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And one of those, two of them are found. Prabhupada describes that they were written by Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya and then discarded. But some of the devotees gathered them, and two of them are still remaining. And one of them has stood since then, up until the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, as the principal verse describing Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, resulting from Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's hearing the Atmarama verse that we're going to be discussing shortly. So, I'm tempted to go into that verse that Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya composed, but maybe another time. Back to the Atmarama verse. So, the Atmarama verse is a very important verse. After Chaitanya Mahaprabhu described it elaborately in 64 different ways to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, later on, when Sanatan Goswami, who is also a great devotional scholar, visited in Puri with Mahaprabhu, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya said, I heard you explain the Atmarama verse to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya in 64 different ways. Could you explain it to me too? And like repeat performance. And Mahaprabhu made some humble expression that I don't know what I said to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, but I can attempt to explain something about the Atmarama verse, and presented in that his explanation of the Atmarama verse. So it's in Mahaprabhu's Leela in Puri that Atmarama verse is a very important verse in converting Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, this big pundit, filled with impersonalism, karmakanda rituals, to the point of becoming a great devotee. And as thousands of disciples all became devotees of Mahaprabhu also, simultaneously. And Sanatana Goswami, chief amongst, or eldest amongst the six Goswamis, the principal followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, also heard the Atmarama verse. That's a very important verse. Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, in his biography of Mahaprabhu's life, dedicated one whole chapter to put a big banner about Atmarama verse is really important. So, what leads into the Atmarama verse are also some very important verses. What we discussed this morning is text 7, which is part of a group of verses that are 4, 5, 6, and 7, which are the realization of Vyasadeva, according to the instructions of Narada Muni, what the essence of the Bhagavatam should be. And it was based upon the realization of Vyasadeva in complete trance, fixed, samyak praniyate male, bhakti yogena manasi, samyak praniyate male, etc. Those very important verses of what he realized about sakshat purusham purnam, the personality of Godhead in the spiritual world, with all of his expansions, all of his energies, the whole spiritual abode, the material realm, the Supreme Lord, the source of all things, with all of his energies, and the living entity, and living entity in the conditioned and the liberated state, and what makes the difference, and how to bring about the liberated state from the conditioned state. And he wrote one literature specifically and explicitly to accomplish that through the glorification of the personality Godhead, his Katha, Krishna Katha. And then this morning we read the concluding verse, which is, when one hears Krishna Katha, what happens? How does, in sequence, the conditioned soul become unconditioned or free from shoka moho bhaya apaha? Eradicated those harassing features of material existence. It'd be nice to not be harassed anymore. And it's tenacious, like Gajendra with a crocodile in his leg. 100 years he fought with that crocodile, and the crocodile wouldn't let go. And how many lifetimes are we fighting with harassing feature of material energy? It's not just a few years or a few months or whatever it is that we've been practicing devotional life. It's lifetimes, and won't let go. No matter what twists and turns and gymnastics we do, and doesn't let go. We're covered. Got you covered. But there is the mitigating process is described in those very, very important verses. They receive much attention from our acharyas. So that's where we ended, that the mitigating process and how it works when one properly applies it. And now we're reading starting with text 8, 9, and 10. 10 is the Atmaram verse. So 8, the great sage Vyasadeva, after compiling the Srimad Bhagavatam and revising it, taught it to his son, Shukadeva Goswami, who was already engaged in self-realization. Wasn't exactly already engaged in self-realization as much as he was already liberated. You know, this position of Shukadeva Goswami, even within the womb of his mother, Vyas was the father, and within the womb of Vyasadeva's wife was Shukadeva Goswami, and he was Brahman realized. He was so realized in Brahman, that he was thinking, within the womb of my mother, outside the womb of my mother, it's all one. So I'll just stay in the womb of my mother, because outside, there may be some chance I can fall prey to Maya. I don't want to fall prey to Maya, so I'll stay within the womb of my mother. You know how long he stayed within the womb of his mother? Or those of you who have carried children? Think about this one. Not just 9 months, 10 months, not just 1 year, 16 years. Poor mother. So his mother was very concerned. My dear Vyas, do something, please. So he called for Krishna. Krishna! Krishna came. And Krishna promised, Shukadev, don't worry, I promise you won't fall into Maya. Please come out. So he came out on Krishna's promise that he wouldn't fall into Maya. And from the moment he was born, he left home. He went, did not undergo purificatory processes as the son of a Brahmin would ordinarily do, because 16-year-old boy, it's time for his Upanayana, but he just left home. And he went down the street, stark naked, or clothed by the four directions. And as he went down the road, Vyas ran behind him, come back! Sukadev, come back! The only response he heard was the echo of his own voice from the trees. Said nothing. Gone. There's more to the story, but back to this section. But he, after writing the Srimad Bhagavatam, just like after Vyas wrote the Vedas, this is now going back to chapter 4, Vyas entrusted each of the four Vedas to specific disciples that they should preserve it and maintain it for posterity. So with Srimad Bhagavatam, it was such a elevated literature. It wasn't just one of his disciples, but it was this qualified personality. His own son, Shukadev Goswami. Here's a detail from Brahma Vaivarta Purana. Very nice. While still within the womb of his mother, he instructed the essential verses, meaning the four essential verses of the Bhagavatam, the Chaturasloki verses, and Shukadev Goswami left. So Brahma Vaivarta Purana describes that Shukadev wanted to train his son in the entire Bhagavatam, but he had gone. So he sent one Brahmin into the forest, disguised as a hunter, into the forest, and the hunter was reciting slokas from the Bhagavatam. And Shukadeva Goswami heard those verses from the Bhagavatam. And one particular verse describes, from the 10th canto, it describes Krishna entering into the forest of Vrindavan. And in detail describing the ornaments that he was wearing, his typical Bhagavatam verses. Very brilliant yellow pitambar dhoti, a blue flower perched on his ear, and his flute pursed upon his lips, and sweet sounds coming, his beautiful lotus eyes, peacock feather in his hair, garland of forest flowers, and Krishna was charming all the inhabitants of Vrindavan forest. When Shukadeva Goswami heard the verse, he became ecstatic. Tell me more, say more. Where have you heard this? He said, well, I can't tell you, but you'd have to come with me, and then I can... Yes, yes. He attracted him by the slokas of the Bhagavatam, and he brought him back to the presence of Vyasadeva, who then instructed him in the entire Srimad Bhagavatam. So that's a little detail of the essence of the Bhagavatam and then the complete Bhagavatam. And then taught it to his own son, Srila Shukadeva Goswami, who was already engaged in self-realization. In the purport, Prabhupada deals with a little bit with the intellectual scholarly blah 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 stuff about when was the Bhagavatam compiled. So he gives a little bit of that history of when was it actually written. So the Chaturshloki, and then written and then spoken to Shukadeva Goswami. So Prabhupada pinpoints that it was after the birth of Maharaj Parikshit. It was after Krishna's disappearance and before Maharaj Parikshit's disappearance. So during Maharaj Parikshit's life, it was composed and spoken to Shukadeva and spoken to Maharaj Parikshit. He says further, Srimad Bhagavatam was compiled not less than 5,000 years ago. Mahabharata was compiled before Srimad Bhagavatam, and the Puranas were compiled before Mahabharata. That is an estimation of the date of compilation of the different Vedic literatures. The synopsis of Bhagavatam, 4 verses, was given before the detailed description under the instruction of Narada. Got it? When Narada visited Vyas, who had already compiled all the Vedas, the synopsis of the Bhagavatam was there. Narada instructed. Vyas meditated, he had his realization, and then he compiled the full Srimad Bhagavatam and then instructed it to Shukadeva Goswami. That's the chronology that's identified. The synopsis of Srimad Bhagavatam was given before the detailed description under the instruction of Narada. Srimad Bhagavatam is the science for following the path of Nivritti Marg. The path of Pravritti Marg was condemned by Narada. What's the difference between Nivritti and Pravritti Marg? Who can say? Besides you two?
Karma Kanda
is Pravritti. And? Bhagavad Marg is Nivritti. And what's the difference between those two? Pravritti and Nivritti. Mataji? Yes? Yeah. It's in specifically, Pravritti means expanding one's field of material activities. Expanding, increasing involvement with the material energy. On a higher grade, a higher elevation, elevated standard of material involvement. Like elevation to the heavenly planets. Or even in this lifetime, enjoying on a higher grade of material happiness. Pravritti. And Nivritti means progressively decreasing material involvement for the higher purpose of increasing one's contact with the Supreme directly. So Prabhupada is saying, Narada had condemned what Vyas had written in the Karma Kanda section of the Vedas, which encourages increased levels of material happiness through proper sacrifice according to Karma Kanda rituals. Condemned. And so the Bhagavatam language in the introductory chapters is Dharma Projita Kaitavotra Paramo Nirmatsaranam Satamso. The Karmakanda Pravritti section of the Vedas is rejected and Nivritti is accepted. The goal of us as devotees, put it in real personal language, is we accept that there's a certain standard of material comfort that we feel that we need in order to be peaceful. In the course of our devotional lives, we should be seeking ways of simplifying all of that, progressively, gradually, less, of whatever that standard is, so that we can be peaceful. We need to be peaceful to prosecute our Krishna consciousness. But whatever that standard is, we want to move the fulcrum a little bit, so that we don't have to involve ourselves with material complexity so much. And progressively, less and less. Except for Krishna's service. When Krishna's service is involved, we may accept some effort to build a nice temple for Krishna. And with that building of a nice temple for Krishna, there's complexity. Or publishing Prabhupada's books. And with that, there's complexity. You have to deal with printers, you have to deal with money, you have to deal with binders, you have to deal with editing and transcribing. And so much complexity. But for the direct glorification of the personality of Godhead, we can accept like that. Remember when one sannyasi, who's Satsurup Maharaj, when he didn't like management so much. He was my first temple president in Boston. But he never really liked management. He really wasn't good at it either. But when he took sannyas, he said, Prabhupada, now that I've taken sannyas, can I be freed from management? And Prabhupada said, no, now that you've taken sannyas, you manage with detachment. And he gradually gave him some service to be greatly reduced in his management. He went to a service like being in charge of a library party from the position of being Prabhupada's secretary for some time. But secretary wasn't uncomplicated. Being Prabhupada's secretary was also very complicated. Degrees of complication with different issues and things, that just helping Prabhupada address things. Then Prabhupada gave him the service of being in charge of the library party, which meant some academically proficient devotees joined his party, and they went and distributed standing orders of Prabhupada's books to universities, starting in America, then Europe, and then India, and then behind the Iron Curtain. Which, one of the acclaims of Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj was he was the best. He was fearless. He risked his life, literally, and was the best. In very, very challenging situations, managed to distribute. So, for Krishna's service, we can do those things, but for our own material comfort, it's nivritti. Nivritti. Gradually decreasing whatever it is that we think that we need to be peaceful so we can prosecute our Krishna consciousness. Let it become more simple over a period of time. Progressively. So that, not just so we can be tyagis, but so that we can connect with Krishna more. Okay, so that's one verse. Text number 8. Prabhupada concludes the purport there. The theme of Srimad Bhagavatam is the cure of the materialistic disease of the human being, or stopping completely the pangs of material existence. Okay, now comes the verse before the Atmaram verse. Sri Shaunaka asks Suta Goswami, I'll paraphrase, what? Shukadeva Goswami went to school? He had to go do some homework and study some books on something. He's already liberated. What's going on? Can you explain? Why did he undertake the trouble to undergo the study of such a vast literature? And the answer is the Atmarama verse. So who knows the Atmarama verse? Who can recite the Sanskrit? Atmaramas chamunayo. You know the verse?
I
you know those two lines? Okay, anyone? Atmaramas cha munayo nirgranta api urukrame kurvanti ahaitukim bhaktim Itam Bhuta Gano Harihi. So, from that 64 meanings, the purport is only 3 pages long, 3.5 pages long, and I'll try to summarize it. First, Prabhupada addresses, in this sloka, the Lord is addressed in two ways, as Urukrama and Hari. Why Urukrama? What does Urukrama mean? He explains, Urukrama means the one whose activities are glorious. The one whose activities are glorious. There's a second meaning. The Lord who delivered Vamana is known as Urukrama, because krama also means step. And with his second step, he covered the entire universe. So who can have such step? Urukrama can have such step. But he is also known as Trivikrama. With his third step, he placed his foot on the head of Bali Maharaj. Trivikrama. So how is it that the Lord is he whose activities are glorious? Prabhupada writes, his activities are so glorious that he has created the spiritual world by his internal potency and the material world by his external potency. He's all-pervading, as the Super Soul just goes on describing. Like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, what's the use of describing my vibhutis? With just a single fragment of myself, I pervade and support the whole universe. So there's... who can do that? Who can say that? With a single fragment of myself, I pervade and support the whole universe. Only one person can say that. Urukrama, he whose activities are glorious. His activities cannot be compared to anyone else's, and therefore, Urukrama is used here, and is appropriate only to him. So, Atmaramas Chamunayo Yirgrantha Api Urukrame. So it's the vocative. Urukrame. Addressing Urukrama. Then Prabhupada says, word by word he goes into this. So then Kurvanti is the next word that gets the attention. According to the Sanskrit verbal arrangement, Kurvanti refers to doing something for someone else. So when you say do or work, there are different terms for that, like karma or... Kurvanti means specifically they do something for someone else. So the Atmaramas, who's an Atmarama? Completely satisfied. There's nothing needed outside of oneself. They're satisfied within. So the Atmaramas want to do something for someone else. And who is that someone else? Urukrama they want to do something for. Kurvanti. Ahaitukim bhaktim. It's ahaitukim bhaktim. So that's the next word that receives attention. Hetu. Hetu means cause. A-hetu means without cause. Kurvanti ahaitukim bhaktim. So devotional service is done without cause, ahaitukim, for someone else. Love. When you do something selflessly, what's the motivation? To do something, there's a motivation, but not a selfish motivation, not a materially caused motivation. It's love. It's spiritual. Not like the love of the material world where you expect something. Without expecting something. That's the platform of the Atmaramas. And that's the platform of Shukadeva Goswami. Why did he undergo the study of Srimad Bhagavatam? didn't need knowledge. He didn't need happiness. He was wanting to do for the pleasure of Purukrama. He whose activities are glorious. Prabhupada writes, therefore it means that the Atmaramas render devotional service to the Lord not for personal interest, but for the pleasure of the Lord. So you hear Prabhupada use this phrase over and over, causeless devotional service, pure devotional service, unmotivated devotional service. That's what the Atmarama verse is exposing, that or expanding that notion. Kurvanti ahaitukim bhaktim. Then Prabhupada, in the purport, delineates and then brings it as a theme several times. What are the hetus for material action? For material activity, there's a cause. One of the causes is material enjoyment. People do something because they want to enjoy their senses. Or some persons do send things on the material platform because they want mystic power, which is another material thing. Those of you that have read Nectar Devotion, you know mystic power is just a subtle way of doing the same things people try to do by gross means. Like becoming very big or becoming very small or becoming light and flying, becoming very heavy. When Krishna manifested all of those opulence because he's Yogeshwara, he would sometimes become big, like in the Kaliyadamana Leela. He expanded his body bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger when he was in the coils of Kali, and Kali was... I couldn't get to it. Then Krishna became very small and slipped out. Well, Krishna is Yogeshwara. Or with Balaram, he jumped off the mountain when Jarasandha was chasing him, and they just went for a big ride. Or he became very heavy when being carried by Trinavarta. So heavy, Trinavarta was losing momentum, but Krishna wouldn't let go. He held on to his neck. So Trinavarta came crashing to the ground, smashed on a slab of stone and died. Became heavy, he became very light, he became very small. Krishna's Yogeshwara. So where do the yogis get their powers from? From Yogeshwara. But even the way that they manifest them, they can make a planet, but, or make something that flies in the sky, or make something manifest in their hand, Prapti Siddhi, but everything just manifests by Krishna's will. So these are material arts that by material science, they try to send something into space or make something very light or make something small. Entering into a solid object, they drill or make a tunnel or something. They're material perfections. So those who want material perfections seek mystic siddhis. Prabhupada identifies there's the principal ones are 8 in number. And material sense gratification is unlimited. So many. Can't count them all. Or liberation. There's 5 kinds of liberation. So there's aspiring for liberation, according to the Vedic picture of things. Aspiring for liberation is the flip side of material involvement is I want out. Bhakti is not I want out. Bhakti is I want to serve Krishna wherever you want me to be. As long as I can be engaged in your service. It's not I want out. It's not aspiring for the 5 kinds of liberation. So then, therefore, unalloyed devotion, that's what the Atmaramas do and the kind that Shukadeva Goswami does in Kurvanti Ahaitukim Bhaktim, render service without desire for the above mentioned 3 categories of personal benefits, and the powerful personality of God in Sri Krishna can be fully satisfied by such unalloyed devotees only. That means we have to work on our devotion so that we can satisfy Krishna, because mixed devotion is mixed. It's just like if somebody comes to you, "Oh, Nanda Kumar, you're my dear friend." "Yes, Maharaj, you need something?" It's not the same as just being someone's friend without any expectation. And then Nanda Kumar is going to say, "Maharaj, is there something I can do for you?" And Maharaj is going to say, I'm okay, I'm satisfied, thank you very much, though. "Well, but something, let me do something." "No, it's okay." It's a different kind of relationship when it's without expectation. And certainly with Krishna also. So, no one can satisfy Krishna as much as one who comes to him without expectation. But as long as we have material expectation, it taints the relationship. So Prabhupada describes that in the next paragraph. Unalloyed devotional service of the Lord progresses in different stages. Practice of devotional service in the material field is of 81 different qualities. What's that 81 different qualities? Those of you that have heard Prabhupada speak again and again know he speaks of the modes of nature. The modes of nature, 3 times 3 is... What's 3 times 3? 9, okay. And what's 9 times 9? 81. In this way, the modes of nature expand unlimitedly, how they mix with one another. So that's what he means, 81 different varieties. And 81 times 81, whatever that is, it just keeps expanding. And Prabhupada would say, in this way we get 8,400,000 species. It's just the modes of nature mixing in different combinations. We read yesterday evening Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur's purport about where it's in the preliminary stages, bhakti, mixed with the modes of nature. Lord Kapiladev is asked by Devahuti, "Devotional service is pure. Is it possible to render devotional service impurely?" And Kapiladev's reply is yes. According to one's involvement of the modes of material nature, there's devotional service influenced by... Devotional service is pure, but our consciousness can be tainted by ignorance or passion or goodness. And then there's pure devotional service. So this is what he's describing. In practice of devotional service in the material field, Gona Bhakti is one term that you're... Prakrita Bhakti, another term, is of 81 different qualities. And above such activities is the transcendental practice of devotional service. That's what the Atmaram verse is speaking about. That's the message of the Bhagavatam. That's why it's such an important verse. It's that which Shukadeva Goswami is attracted to, and my dear devotees, we should become attracted to, although we may not be there. We can get to that platform by associating with the Bhagavatam in the way that Shukadeva Goswami associated with the Bhagavatam, at least following in his footsteps to get to Shuddha Bhakti, this unmotivated, Kurvanti Ahetukim Bhaktim. And that is Sadhana Bhakti. Whoa. So we're not doing Sadhana Bhakti. But if we're following Rupa Goswami's teaching, if we're Rupanugas, then that also is by cultivation of that standard, although we're down here, we're not envious of what that standard is. We recognize that's the standard and we're striving for that standard. That's also counted as Uttam Bhakti, because Bhakti is Uttam Bhakti. That's what Rupa Goswami's definition is in Nectar Devotion. What's the definition of Nectar Devotion? About what is bhakti? Anyabhilashita shunyam jnana karma janavratam anukodena krishna anushilanam bhaktir uttama. Bhaktir uttama is bhakti because bhakti is uttam bhakti that's unmixed. And sadhana bhakti is part of the topic of uttam bhakti for us because we're followers of Rupa Goswami. As long as we're not envious of that standard and accepting the standard and striving by the teachings of Rupa Goswami to reach that standard, not just be a mixed devotee in Hari Bol. But strive for the standard of pure devotion. Then it's sadhana bhakti. Almost done. Prabhupada gets into something that's a little esoteric next, so I won't spend a lot of time on it, but those of you that like esoteric things, here we go. It's first canto esoteric, it's okay. He writes, when unalloyed practice of sadhana bhakti is matured into transcendental love of God, the transcendental loving service to the Lord begins gradually developing into 9 progressive stages of loving service under the headings of attachment, love, affection, feelings, affinity, adherence, following, ecstasy, and intense feelings of separation. That's on the Prema Bhakti stage. There's 9 further sub-stages. Then he explains it. The attachment of an inactive devotee, meaning shanta rasa, the first of the 5 rasas, neutrality, or the inactive devotee, like, you know, rocks in Vrindavan. Inactive devotee, shanta, neutrality. Develops up to the stage of transcendental love of God. Attachment of an active servitor, dasya rasa, develops up to the stage of adherence, and that for a friendly devotee, what's that rasa? Sakya rasa. Develops up to the stage of following, and the same is also the case for the parental devotees. Devotees in conjugal love develop ecstasy up to the stage of intense feelings of separation. He doesn't elaborate, he just announces it and moves on. These are some of the features of unalloyed devotional service of the Lord. Just stay tuned for further developments in the unfolding of the ecstasy of devotional service. Now back to devotional service. Back to the Atmaram verse. Itam Bhuta. So we'll go back to the Sanskrit. That's the last line. Atmaramas chamunayo nirgrantha api uru krame kurvanti ahaitukim bhaktim itam bhuta guno harihi. Hari is it the last word? Hari has the connotation that he takes away the yucky stuff, the impurity in the hearts of the conditioned soul. So they become the perfected souls. Now, itam bhuta, according to Hari Bhakti Sudhodaya, means complete bliss. That's not like little drops, but it's complete bliss. Itam bhuta. Guno Hari. Hari takes away the influence of the gunas, leaving us in that itam bhuta stage, completely blissful state, the natural blissful state of the soul. Transcendental bliss and the realization of impersonal Brahman in Hari Bhakti Sudhodaya becomes comparable to the scanty water contained in a pit made of a cow's hoof, which is nothing compared to the ocean of bliss of the vision of the personality of Godhead. And remember, Vyasadeva saw the personality of Godhead, and he was experiencing this Itam Bhuta, and that's what the Srimad Bhagavatam is, describing that. From that platform, Bhagavatam was composed. And so the messages of Bhagavatam are Itam Bhuta. Guno Hadihi. The personal form of Lord Krishna is so attractive that it comprehends all attraction, all bliss, and all rasas. Not just shanta. Shanta meaning cessation of the banging on the head of material sufferings. And when the bangings on the head stop, oh, what a relief. But that's not Krishna. Krishna is Itam Bhuta. He comprehends all rasas, all bliss, all happiness, all tastes. So strong is this attraction for Krishna on the Atmaram stage is that it completely defeats, it rejects any other offer of happiness. Would my dear Shukadeva Goswami, or one on such a platform, would you like some sense gratification? Would you like some mystic cities? Would you like liberation? Would you like to hear Krishna Katha? Yes, yes, yes. Then Prabhupada writes very beautifully, there's no need for logical arguments in support of this statement. But out of one's own nature, one becomes attracted by the qualities of Lord Sri Krishna. So it's beyond the reason that I feel attraction for Krishna Katha is because I understand that it does these things that doesn't happen by doing those things, and so I want Krishna Katha. There's no rational argument that brings it about. It flows out of one's own nature. So that's not our position. We're doing sadhana bhakti. Or at least we're striving for that position where bhukti, mukti, siddhi, kami, sakale, ashanta, according to Lord Chaitanya. Sakale, ashanta, one's mind becomes disturbed, not peaceful. As long as we're striving for bhukti, or mukti, or siddhi, those such desires, sakale ashanta, they make the mind disturbed. But when Krishna bhakti, when one wants Krishna, devotion for Krishna alone, and we do our devotional service with that, at least that aspiration, that cultivation, anushilana, in the language of Rupa Goswami, with striving, cultivating like that, trying for that kind of position. Then we'll come to that position. You cultivate that and you'll come to that stage. Then he explains, almost done, he explains that Shukadeva Goswami, as an example of an Atmarama, he wasn't attracted to anything material. As he was walking down the road, 16-year-old boy, completely naked, in front of a whole lake full of women that were also bathing in the lake, and he was undisturbed, and they were undisturbed. They didn't even bother to cover themselves, although they were bathing naked in the lake. But when Vyas went by, because he's a householder, they immediately covered themselves, because they understand he's a householder, he makes these distinctions. Not that he's an agitated old man, but he makes those distinctions, otherwise how can you be a householder? But Shukadeva Goswami doesn't even have position in making those distinctions. So they didn't cover themselves. And he had no attraction. He had no material attraction. No kama, bhukti or mukti or siddhi attraction. But he had attraction. attraction for Krishna Katha. And similarly, the four Kumaras, the second example, is that when the four Kumaras, they enter to the gates of Vaikuntha, they didn't have material attraction, but when they, according to the fourth canto of Bhagavatam, they smelled the fragrance of the tulsi buds and the sandalwood paste on the lotus feet of the Lord, and they became very attracted, not to something material. So the idea here is, Shukadev Goswami, being on the already liberated platform, hearing Krishna Katha, means it's not material. Like Krishna is not material, like the Vaikuntha realm is not material, the Bhagavatam is not material. It's not a material subject matter, therefore Shukadev Goswami was interested. Not for mastery of another bit of information, but provoking, it's just spontaneously provoked his loving attraction for the Lord. But also give the example of Rukmini. She became attracted just by hearing about him. She never saw him. She just heard about him. Just like us, we haven't seen Krishna, but we've heard about Krishna. But look what happened to Rukmini. She gave her life to Krishna. I don't want to marry anyone else but you. And if you don't agree, then I'll just, for lifetimes, wait till you marry me. Please rescue me from this difficult situation. Here's how you can do it. If you so desire. Come at a particular time. I'm going to go to the temple. You come with your chariot and zoom, off we go. So then, Hari. He is the Lord who vanquishes everything inauspicious and takes away the mind of the devotee by awarding pure transcendental love. By remembering the Lord in acute distress, one can be freed from all varieties of miseries and anxieties. Remembrance of the Lord is mentioned so many times. Man mana, always think of the Lord, of a mad bhakto, or one who's mind is always fixed upon me and intelligence always engaged in my service. In such a state, one always lives in me, always, without a doubt. Krishna described in the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. So many verses are there about the importance of fixing the mind upon Krishna, and he's Hari, he carries the mind, not just like our own effort. He attracts, he's Krishna. Krishna means all attractive. He attracts the mind to him. If we just pay attention to him instead of the other stuff that our mind is currently distracted by. Gradually the Lord vanquishes all obstacles on the path of devotional service of a pure devotee. And the result of 9 devotional activities such as hearing and chanting becomes manifested. So emphasis here is going to the attractive power of Krishna. And why did Shukadeva Goswami study? That's what the sages want to know, and Sutta gives the answer. It's not like studying like we study something because we want to master something. It was just attraction to Krishna. His mind is attracted to the all-attractive. Because Krishna is all-attractive and not material. And his mind is attracted to not material, all-attractive Krishna. That's the end of the purport. By his personal features and transcendental attributes, the Lord attracts all psychological activities of a pure devotee. This attraction is so powerful that a pure devotee never hankers for any one of the 4 principles of religion. So this is another item, not bhakti, mukti, siddhi, nor the principles of religion. Dharma, artha, kama, moksha is mentioned again. Mukti or moksha. Nothing material. We're not in that position, but if we hear Krishna Katha, which was the verse that we studied this morning, that can become our gift also, gift of Krishna, Hari. Takes away the inauspicious and gives the auspicious. Which is, I'll end with this, connecting this with Rupa Goswami's teachings, those of you who have studied Nectar of Devotion know that in chapter 1, the title of chapter 1 is Six Characteristics of Pure Devotional Service. And the first two of the six has just been described. The first two characteristics correspond with sadhana bhakti. The second two correspond with bhava bhakti, and the final two correspond with prema bhakti. So the two that correspond with sadhana bhakti, that's what we're doing, is kleshagni and shubhadha. Kleshagni means the eradication of kleshas. Sadhana bhakti is so powerful that the sufferings that we undergo can be removed just by sadhana bhakti. Because he's Hari, he takes them away. But not only he takes them away, he gives something. From our hand, he's taking away that what our attachments are, but he's putting something else in our hands. Himself. Shubha dha. The beginning of all shubha, all auspiciousness. Just from sadhana bhakti. But it needs to be the sadhana bhakti that Rupa Goswami is outlining. It's not just doing mechanically this and not doing that. It's aspiring for, or anukul, oh, excuse me, anushilana. It's cultivating that which is what Lord Chaitanya wanted to give us, Shuddha Bhakti. And the Bhagavatam wants to give us Shuddha Bhakti. It's really clear. That's what the gift we're supposed to hold our hands out and receive. But if our hands are filled with other stuff, Hari takes the other stuff and gives us the real thing. If that's what we want. If we've heard the message and our heart is moved by that message. So, Rupa Goswami's teachings are directly based upon Srimad Bhagavatam, as are Lord Chaitanya's teachings based upon Srimad Bhagavatam. And the Satrama Shloka is teaching this same message, these first two features of sadhana bhakti. So, for some of you that don't like philosophy, this has been pretty boring. And those of you that like the philosophical connection between what we do, what our life is made up of, and the authority of scripture that supports what we do, this is strong. Again, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami chose to dedicate a whole chapter of Chaitanya Charitamrita to describe what we just did in whatever much time, an hour, 45 minutes. So the philosophical grounding is there. We can understand how this process works. So it's not only for, the Bhagavatam is not only for Shukadeva Goswami, and, you know, we're left out. Nor is it just for those that are stuck with material attachments and not for the Paramahamsas. It's for the Paramahamsas, ordinary people, and everybody in between. Someone that's somewhere on the path of spiritual life. Because the principle is very powerful and universally acts. Hare Krishna. So any discussion of this nice Atmaram verse?
The question that I'm having was, you said that Shukadeva Goswami came out of his mother's womb on the promise of Krishna. I was wondering, he's a liberated soul, but
it's Leela. We have that painting on the wall in the Radhagovinda temple in New York. Krishna has come to the cottage of Vyas, and his mother, Sukadeva Goswami's mother, is there with, you know, very matured pregnancy. And Krishna is giving his promise to Shukadeva Goswami. It's okay, Shukadeva, come on out. Your poor mother, give her a break. Okay.
This is regarding my understanding of what I heard in the class. That we need to be, at least I need to be simple, be peaceful.
Nivritti. Yeah.
Being a grihastha, what happens is like, well, how do I draw the peaceful line? Because something or other.
I use very simple language. And I'll repeat it. What we require to be peaceful.
That requirement.
That's subjective. The line moves. So you look over a long period of time, not just this moment. Over a long period of time. What do I, let me try to minimize, but not minimize to an extreme that I'm not peaceful. And my family is not peaceful. Let me move that mind that direction. That's nivritti. And whenever that line goes, is so that I can remain peaceful. Or steadily over a period of time. But I'm always looking to move it further to the less involvement with the material energy. And more involvement with the internal energy. That means more devotional service. Like the question one devotee asked yesterday evening about, you know, there's expectations from family members sometimes for some financial assistance, but there's also devotees in the temple and then other things and other things. So it's the same question. You're doing your duties religiously. As far as possible, you want to expand the internal potency's influence and minimize the external potency's influence. So, like say, how much eating I require, how much sleeping I require. We want to spiritualize those activities, but we also want to, within reason, not something fanatical or extreme that I can't maintain, but let me minimize this and that and stuff. Do I really need this stuff? Should I go and acquire, you know, so this is like an advertisement against the gross national product, or, you know, consumer economics. It's not going to lead to satisfaction. But some things I require. And they're subjectively, that's determined, and it will move. We want it to move. Incrementally, as our Krishna consciousness becomes stronger, it will move. And consciously we move it.
Okay. I would like to say something. Not elaborate, I mean, not that I know as much as you do, because I did not read any of these books, but he questioned saying that 16 years Sukadeva was in the womb. The mother, I think I would like to look at the same aspect in a different way. That Sukadeva, although soul was liberated, I think he had hesitation saying that he could still succumb to the material.
He was cautious. A liberated soul is not a fool. A liberated soul is going to be cautious.
He was cautious and he was afraid saying that he could get attached to this material.
And so, since it's all one, he's staying here, it's fine. Whatever type of liberation one is in, one is cautious. Out of respect for the potency of Maya, a liberated soul is cautious, isn't it?
So what Krishna offered is that he assured saying that no, if you are conscious, you will not get attached to the material comfort of it.
Yeah.
So that is the, even after 16 years of debating between whether to attach or detach.
Well, you're putting thoughts in Shukadeva Goswami's mind. He wasn't debating whether to detach or attach. He wasn't debating. He wasn't hovering on the mental platform. Should I be attached or should I not be attached? He was not on the Vyudhavikalpa platform. He was clear. One who is clear is also cautious. There's a nice example of, another example of this in the Bhagavatam is King Priyavrata. King Priyavrata was the elder brother of King Uttanapada. And because he was the elder brother, son of Swayambhuva Manu, he was entitled to the throne of Swayambhuva Manu. But Priyavrata, even as a young man, he said, "Dad, oh thanks. Let my younger, he's very qualified. Uttanapada is a good boy. Let him become king and let me go to the forest and perfect my devotion. Is that alright? May I have your blessings?" And you can have my blessings and go to the forest. They went to the forest. And for a long period of time, with no attraction for anything material, the lineage of the kings followed Uttanapada. And Uttanapada's son was Dhruva. And from Dhruva, so many other kings they're mentioned in the, but after a certain point in time, King Prachinibari, his sons became renounced under the influence of Narada and Lord Shiva. So they never became married and the lineage was broken. Here is poor Swayambhuva Manu, he's in a fix. He's got to have somebody take over the responsibility. So he went to Priyavrata and said, "Can you take the kingdom?" He didn't say no, but he didn't say yes either. Because I have no attraction for that. My dear father, dad, you know, how long ago I had no attraction and now I have no attraction. I'm fixed. But he didn't say no because he didn't want to say no to his father. So his spiritual master Narada came. And he thought, oh, Narada is going to be able to fix this problem. He really understands the renunciation. But Narada didn't want to contradict Swayambhuva Manu either. He's his brother. Swayambhuva Manu is a direct son of Brahma and Narada is a direct son of Brahma. And so Brahma came and Brahma promised Priyavrata, "Don't worry, I give you my assurance. You'll not succumb. Even if the way that his benediction went was, even if you become involved with the material energy, because king means you have to have queen, and queen and kingdom means you have to have wealth, and even a fixed person in contact with the opposite sex and wealth, and one's mind can become agitated. So even if that happens, my promise is you'll be protected in the end." So, with Brahma's promise, and it was like he was being ganged up on, 3 Mahajans said, "Please do it." So he accepted. And he succumbed. Shukadeva Goswami didn't. He stayed in that renounced position. It's not like a cookie cutter formula that you get involved in family life and you gotta get plowed under or something by the material energy. But that happened. He became attached. But the benediction of... So, a liberated soul is very careful. It's not that the liberated soul is thinking, should I or shouldn't I? He wasn't debating. He was cautious. You can say afraid. He was cautious. Here's something that Srila Prabhupada said.
Story.
Nice Prabhupada story. Some of you have heard this Prabhupada story. Prabhupada's schedule, one part of his schedule was in the afternoon, he opened his room for darshan so devotees could come. Sometimes he would host guests. Sometimes it was just the devotees, depending different days. So one day was the devotees. And they were seated in the room like we're seated, and Prabhupada was saying, "So what is the difference between you and me?" And the devotees were having a great time glorifying Prabhupada. "Oh, Prabhupada, you're this, and you're that, and you're the other thing. Oh, you're so wonderful." And Prabhupada he had a certain point he wanted to make, and he said, "The difference between you and me is You can fall into Maya and I cannot. And everyone said, Jai Prabhupada. Okay, so now it's time to go give the evening class. And the system that Prabhupada used when he went to give class is he went into the temple room, went before the deities, paid obeisances before the deities, took darshan, offered prayers, and then went back and said, I'm Vyasa-san, and he sang Jai Radha Madhava, and gave class, went back to his quarters. So he did that. He went into the temple room and was offering prayers. Audible prayers. The secretary right next to him could hear Prabhupada offering prayers. And then Vyasa-san, Jai Radha Madhava, gave class, went to his room, and the secretary said, Prabhupada, what were those prayers that you were offering to Radha Govinda? He said, I was offering prayers to Radha Govinda. Please protect me always from the influence of Maya. And then what he said, but Prabhupada, you said, you can't fall prey to Maya. The difference between yourself and ourself is, you can't fall prey to Maya. And Prabhupada said, now you understand why. I am always praying to Krishna to protect me from Maya. You can say fear. You can say caution. Taking shelter. So the liberated soul is not whimsical. On the contrary, what Prabhupada said, the fault of you Western devotees, we had many faults, but you, the fault of you Western devotees is you flirt with Maya. You go out on the branch as far as you go until you hear the branch crack and then you run back with the trunk. How far can I go flirting with Maya? This is your disease. He gave us some other indications of other diseases. You always want to change things. New, improved. Don't change things. Leave them. I've given you. Leave them. Don't change them. The standards of our devotional practice and so on. So, Shukadeva Swami was cautious. If you like the word afraid, okay. But he wasn't debating, should I or shouldn't I? Not attractive, but cautious, because the Lord's energy is very powerful. He's the master, and I'm tiny. I should be very careful. To always take shelter of Krishna's protection. That's one of the six items of surrender. Feeling oneself to be always protected by the Supreme Lord. But that doesn't mean, I'm always protected by the Supreme Lord, so I can walk across the middle of the freeway at rush hour and no problem because I'm protected by the Supreme Lord. That's foolish. Nor do we flirt with Maya. That's also foolish. Or take risks and do things or associate with the wrong kinds of energy. Wrong kinds of activity. I am Krishna protecting me, it's okay. No. Krishna, please protect me. Feeling oneself always protected by Krishna by actively taking shelter and surrendering unto him. Yes? Sure, sure. In both terms, we're responsible for acting properly. We don't make Krishna go out of the way to protect us because of our foolishness, like the question was asked this morning. If we find ourselves in some difficulty, is it Krishna's test or our foolishness? And my response was, in our level, it's generally our foolishness, not Krishna's just checking us out. Or so we should be responsible for acting properly. And on the other side, if there's something that's improper that we are doing or have done, we accept responsibility for it. But still, not budging an inch from the shelter of Krishna's lotus feet. That's the ultimate responsible act. We may not, in all circumstances of life, know what's appropriate, what should I do in this circumstance. It can be very complicated and not so clear. I've run into one or two of those situations in my life, and at least this much, Krishna, please give me some indication of what's right. I'm not like holding you responsible for my choices, but please help me make the right choice. Because some things are very, 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 very delicate and very subtle. How to do the right thing and how to do it in the right way. I need your... I'll take responsibility, but I need your guidance. Somehow, please give me some indication how to proceed. A spiritual life is a life of responsibility. Prabhupada spoke like that. Do you have something more?
Yes, Maharaj. Until now, I always understood Atmaram to be one who is satisfied with his self.
Yes, it is. That's what it means.
Would it also, like somebody who is hankering for Krishna, is it also an Atmaram?
Say it again, because the fan is a little louder than you. Yes, and here's the explanation why. Self-satisfied does not mean divorced from Krishna. It means happiness in relation to Krishna. The self is not separate from Krishna. So Atmaram means happiness in that relation with Krishna. Like Prabhupada, another way of saying the same thing is self-realization means God-realization. Because the self is not just Brahman. But Brahman is in relation to Parabrahman. The self is in relation to the Supreme Self. We are part and parcel of Krishna, like our discussion this morning. So, Atmaram means my satisfaction, my happiness is in relation to Krishna. Otherwise, we have impersonalism. And Bhagavatam is certainly not impersonal, so it's implicit. Our sense of completeness is in our relationship with Krishna. Our fullness is in our relationship with Krishna. Not my sense of fullness is I'm full and there's Krishna over there and, you know, take him or leave him, but my fullness is over here. It's not what Atmaram is. That's impersonal. Our fullness is in our loving relationship. Again, it would mean love doesn't matter. Love matters because it's our nature. We're loving by nature. Love means there's an object of love and the relationship of love and ourselves, and that's Atmaram. That's fullness. And because of that loving relationship, implicit is loving relationship with others who are also in relation with Krishna, which is everybody. I struggled with this as a teenager growing up in America with a teaching, a religious teaching that said, love your neighbor as yourself. I didn't just like read it, memorize it, and recite it when I was asked what is it, what's the teaching. I tried to live it, but I found it very challenging to love very unlovable people. And I didn't know how to do it. So I would ask. And I never got any good answer. So I gave up. I wasn't satisfied giving up, but I just like put it on a shelf until I came in contact with Krishna consciousness. It's actually the teaching is there, but I didn't understand it. Like one of the devotees was saying, you know, there's things that I don't understand and things that I do understand, and I have trouble even following the things I do understand. So the understanding is, the first teaching is love God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your strength. Following that, when you're on the spiritual platform, God-conscious platform, when there's this Atmaram in your relationship with Krishna established, then you can have love for your neighbor. Then you can see the soul and not the behavior that's bad. You make the distinction between the bad behavior that's bad. But the soul is good because the soul is in relation with Krishna, just forgetful. Maybe deeply, so deeply forgetful, the behavior is so bad. You don't like that bad behavior. That's okay. But love the soul. It's hard to do that. It's nice sounding words. And then when somebody does something really... But that's the teaching. And that's what Atmaram means. It does mean satisfaction within the self. Rama, Atma, Rama. Well, what's the self in relation to Krishna? That's a complete understanding of self. Otherwise, it's an incomplete understanding of self and an incomplete understanding of Atmaram. So our first business is, this is Prabhupada described, our loving relationship with Krishna. That's Atmaram. So, Atmaramas cha munayo nir granti uru api uru krame kurvanti ahetuti. So that's the doubt. Shukadeva Goswami is Atmaram. But the Atmaram, in his fullness of Atmaramness, is attracted to Krishna. That's the exhibition of Atmaram. And minus Krishna, no attraction. That's Atmaram. Krishna, attracted. That's Atmaram. Because that's part of my fullness on the spiritual platform. Okay, anything else? Could you speak a little louder so the people back there can hear you?
I want to hear the Bhagavatam Nadavara Vatati.
You want to hear which?
Bhagavatam Nadavara Vatati, the sloka which Sukadeva Goswami was more attacked.
You want to hear that sloka? I don't know by heart that sloka. You want to? I can paraphrase what that sloka says. You know the sloka?
I know, but I want to hear the full explanation which he was...
I can't do more than what I did.
From your words?
Yeah. I've only heard it described very briefly. I heard it once described in greater detail by Gopi Puranadhara. He recited the verse in Sanskrit, including, you know, the color of the flower is blue. That's another detail. A blue flower tucked over Krishna's ear. And his yellow dhoti, and his lotus eye. So Shukadeva Goswami is describing, or the Bhagavatam Vyasadeva is describing, the darshan of Krishna in the forest. In that verse. And the Atmaram, Shukadeva Goswami, hearing that verse, became attracted. So the indication, the primary, if you forget everything else about this whole discussion, remember this one thing. Krishna Katha is transcendental. And that's the proof is that one who is Atmaram, already liberated, not attracted to anything material, was attracted to Krishna Katha. He was attracted to Srimad Bhagavatam. So it's on the liberated, the book is on the liberated platform, and liberated souls are attracted to it. And the non-liberated souls can also be attracted to it and get attraction for Krishna. That's the important thing out of the whole verse. And the detail is relishing what you want to hear, and I don't know the verse. Gopi Pranadana knows the verse. Maybe I'll write to Gopi Pranadana, ask him to give me the verse, and whatever explanation he can offer, and then I can share that with all of you. Is that all right? Because I'm sure what he has understood, he's read from the commentaries that he's translating. Probably somewhere Jiva Goswami has written about it in the Sandarbhas and in Bhakti Sandarbha or something. And I'll ask Gopi if he'll share that with me. And then I'll share it with all of you. I'll just read what he says. I'll let him know. I'll just read out whatever you write, I'll read to the devotees here. Okay. Anyone else? Yes.
In the morning lecture you said that one's faith determines the realization we get.
Which Faith determines the realizations we get.
Yeah.
So is it the corollary to that once realization is determined, one's faith?
This is a college question. One's realizations don't determine one's faith. One's faith determines one's realizations. I may be in a state where, or one may be in a state where they don't have great realizations. Like, you know, vast realizations. Just like this question that was just asked. But there can be some basic faith that Krishna is all attractive. Krishna is so attractive. Even a conditioned soul like me can become attractive. He's so attractive. Like the discussion in Chaitanya Charitamrita where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was visiting in Srirangam and there was one Brahmin who was illiterate, but his spiritual master had told him to read Srimad Bhagavatam 18 chapters every day, and so he tried, although he couldn't pronounce the words, and he was crying. That was faith. It was also some realization, but his realization was according to his faith. Not his faith was according to his realization.
Maharaj, in the morning you were saying like one starts off with preliminary faith, but then you know, like we go further in Krishna consciousness, if we get some strong realization, then our faith is rocket itself.
But you're skipping something that's very important. Based upon preliminary faith, we get association of devotees who have greater faith and greater realization. So they share something with us. And going back to Thursday evening, that man that just chants all day long and doesn't chant on beads, he has, from his prior experience, he has faith in mantra. So he heard about Maha Mantra, so he's chanting Maha Mantra. Faith in that. Then he gets some realization. Because he acted in knowledge, he gets some realization. And that realization inspires him to go back to the source from the sadhu from which he heard to further hear. And out of the whole things of what he hears, there's something else that resonates. And it's sadhu sangha. It takes him back to that source and connects with that source. And that hearing and association nurtures faith, and that brings about some actions and brings about some realization to go back and hear further. Faith has grown by the act of submission to the transcendental message and incorporating it in one's life. Okay, the children are doing amazingly well, although they're a little restless. It's maybe time to end. Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.